5 years. I'm not the guy who's going to say, don't do drugs, but I will say, don't do meth, kids. You could blow your chance to be in NoFX. Yeah! Eric Melvin brought in Steve Kidwiler, a friend of a friend from the LA metal scene. Eric had moved back to Hollywood, which had been completely taken over by hair rock. Steve had long hair, which I hated, and he was more into metal than punk. But he had loads of technical skills and was great on stage. Steve and I generally got along, but we also rubbed each other the wrong way. The most concrete example I can offer is when he wanted to thank God in the liner notes of one of our records. I didn't realize he was such a religious guy until then. And I'm a rather vocal atheist, so we ended up compromising. The liner notes had a list of all the thank yous, and then we added a line that read, Steve would like to thank God. It wasn't a big fight or anything, just an illustration of how he and I were from different worlds. Despite the personality rift, we were able to put together our first listenable album, S&M Airlines. I consider that to be the first real NoFX album because, despite its flaws, it was a move to a melodic style of songwriting. It was a cross between DI, RKL, and Bad Religion. It wasn't as good as any of them, but we were finally finding our sound. Still, I have a hard time listening to it because my vocals are fucking terrible. Apparently, I could write melodies. I just couldn't sing melodies. We recorded and mixed it in 6 days this time with Brett Gurewitz, and he brought in Greg Graffin from Bad Religion to record some vocal harmonies. We signed to Epitaph in the hopes of getting the record out to more people, and we shot a video for the title track with a young filmmaker Brett had been working with. We knew him at the time as a guitarist for a band called The Little Kings, but most people know him today as Oscar-winning director Gore Verbinski. Even though our video never saw airtime on MTV, and even though we were never featured on any commercial radio stations, S&M Airlines generated our first set of positive reviews, and a gradual uptick in attendance at our shows. The record sold slow, but steady. 2,500 copies in the first year. Not too bad. It was the first time we ever saw NoFX moving forward. The unthinkable was happening. People were liking us. But since we had spent the previous 5 years sounding, performing, and behaving like shit, we had to rebuild our reputation from scratch. And that's hard to do when your drummer has a habit of pissing in people's silverware drawers.
Chapter 45, Smelly. If you look closely at my toes, you'll see faded memories from a night in Milwaukee. I woke up on a hardwood floor as the newly risen sun baked me through the window. The normal hangover symptoms applied, but I didn't understand why my toes hurt. I sat up. My eyes struggled to focus on the bloody mess at the tips of my feet. I wondered out loud, what the fuck had happened? And DJ explained, yeah, buddy, you tattooed yourself last night. On each toe was a letter. TITSNBOOZE, tits and booze. DJ and I had been using that phrase as our rallying cry, tits and booze. But I had drawn the Z backwards, so my toes read, tits and boose. Raymond taught me how to make a prison-style tattoo gun, with a toothbrush, a ballpoint pen, a guitar string, and a motor from a Walkman. Thinking I was Mr. Fucking Rebel, I brought it on tour and scrawled deformed tattoos on any willing victims I could find. I was no artist. I have no idea why anyone would let me permanently etch their skin. But they did. One kid asked for a Samhain skull logo, and when I was done, it looked like a three-year-old had scribbled on him with a dried-out Sharpie. Helen Keller would have been able to create a more distinguishable version of that logo in her sleep. I tattooed a decent-looking spider on a girl's ribcage, but it was ruined when a nasty infection radiated out from it. I wasn't sterilizing the needle. It went from person to person, junkie to junkie. One of the guys from Subculture ended up with an ace of spades that had gotten so gnarly and pus-riddled, it made him look like patient zero of a new strain of smallpox. Who knows what diseases I was passing around? Answer, hepatitis C, most likely, but I'll get to that later. I can't fully blame alcohol and drugs for my behavior. It was probably a natural extension of my class clown cries for acceptance and my love of all things anti-establishment. Every kid tests his or her boundaries when they first leave home. I just happened to leave home in a van full of punks with a homemade tattoo gun. Booze was my fuel, and DJ was my co-pilot. There was never a night on those early tours when we weren't wasted. And there was hardly a night when that didn't lead to some new level of mischief. We were jackass before jackass existed. If we were at a house party where floors were slick with spilled beer, we went human bowling. Spot a group of people standing around, get a running start, and slide on our stomachs into them and see how many we could take out. Jackass is funny when it's on TV, but not so much when it's in your kitchen. We filled people's ice trays with piss and slipped them back into the freezers. Or we just opened up the silverware drawer and peed on them. One guy caught me peeing in his bathtub while scribbling the Dogpatch Winos logo on his bathroom wall with a fat magic marker. There was a perfectly fine toilet inches away, but I insisted on using the tub. He grabbed me by the back of my shirt, threw me on the ground, and when he was done pounding me, I just laughed it off like a psychopath and partied on. One night in Nebraska, we put on a couple of lovely sundresses we found in someone's closet and tied a bunch of tampons to our dreadlocks. Then we dipped the tampons in ketchup because we're idiots. When the party ran out of beer, DJ and I volunteered to make the beer run. We were punks from California, drunk driving through Nebraska in drag, with bloody tampons in our hair. I turned to DJ and said, "Man, I don't want to go to jail looking like this." And at that exact fucking moment, a set of red and blue spinning lights appeared in the rearview mirror. I have no recollection of how I talked myself out of getting arrested and sold for a carton of cigarettes. I just remember the cop staring at me, saying, "Son," and shaking his head in disapproval. There was an art to our mischief. It doesn't take a lot of creativity to smash a TV or to start a fight. We tried to use our imaginations. If I had to take a shit at someone's house, I would first stop in their bedroom and pull the pillowcase off of one of their pillows. After shitting, I would turn the pillowcase inside out and wipe my ass with it. Then I would turn it right side out again, put the pillow back inside, and return it to the bed. The source of the stench would be a mystery since there would be no skid marks on the outside of the pillowcase, and I would be two towns away before they ever figured it out. Okay, so it was the imagination of a drooling 12-year-old, but it was still imagination. Once we were partying at a house and there happened to be a bag of plaster laying around. So when one of the guys at the party passed out, DJ and I put his leg in a cast. I mixed up the plaster with salt because I knew it would make it set faster. The guy had passed out with his legs crossed, so we took a bunch of fabric strips, dipped them into the plaster, and wrapped both of his legs together so he wouldn't be able to walk in the morning. It didn't set in time, though. He just woke up confused a few hours later with a bunch of mushy paste and stiff cloth around his legs and torso. But again, it's the imagination that counts. Occasionally, the impish pranks were overshadowed by utter dickishness or frightening destructiveness. After making a mess of the plaster cast, I was running down the street high on acid, spray painting cars and jumping on them and shouting, "Let's throw a barbecue!" just before throwing a barbecue grill through a plate glass window. And then getting into a fight with an off-duty cop because he was trying to remove his daughter from my presence. I don't know how I didn't get arrested. I would ask the other guys in the band for more details, but they were all hiding from me in the van at the time. I never felt any pangs of guilt, regardless of how much destruction I caused. But the night after the off-duty cop incident, my conscience started to catch up with me. We were staying with an art student who was extremely generous and sweet to us. And in return, I took her brand new Vespa and went wild in the driveway, taking it off jumps. I fucking wrecked the thing. But that's not the part I feel the most guilty about. She told us we could have anything in the fridge except for two particular dishes. Some sort of special pizza and some custom Jell-O mold she had created for her final project for her art school. It was due the next day, and she needed it to graduate. What do you think the first thing I fucking did when she went to bed? I wasn't being punk, I was just being an asshole. I ate her art and betrayed her trust just because I could. I woke up in the morning with her foot on my hair while she was screaming and cutting off my dreadlocks with a pair of scissors. If she had stabbed me in the neck with those scissors instead, no one would have blamed her. Strangely, DJ and I were able to get laid in the midst of all this. You would think girls would be turned off by a guy who accessorized his hair with ketchup-covered sanitary products, or who often rested his dick on people's shoulders until they noticed. But every night, we were the out-of-towners who had the spotlight on us, and we were brimming with unjustified, alcohol-infused confidence. DJ and I had a contest to see who could nail more chicks. We kept a tally on the roof of the van and ended up tied at 12 at the end of our first summer tour. We would jokingly refer to ourselves as the Macho Studs and walk around house parties saying, "Macho Studs, you're a macho stud. Hey, I'm a macho stud. Ladies, you need a macho stud? Because I'm a macho stud." Seriously, is it any wonder they started calling us the Moron Brothers? One night in Michigan, our little comedy routine paid off. A girl from one of the opening bands we played with came up to us and said in her most seductive voice, "I want to fuck the macho studs." Moments later, I was on my back with my eyes closed while she rode on top of me. I sensed something to my left, and I opened my eyes to see a foot by my ear. I looked to the right. Another foot. I looked up. DJ's ginger-haired balls were 6 inches over my forehead, rhythmically tapping against the girl's chin. "Whoa, dude, stop!" We shifted positions, and she was soon blowing me while DJ fucked her from behind. As soon as he entered her, I could see by his strained expression that his race had been run. He pulled his dick out and jerked off all over her back while staring at me cross-eyed. I shouted, dude, and shielded myself from any friendly fire. I decided then that there are some things brothers shouldn't share. Just like our pranks and mischief, my interactions with girls occasionally revealed my darker side. I boned a cute punk girl named Jenny from Nebraska. We passed out naked and drunk in the van, and at 8 a.m. I heard pounding on the window. "Jenny, are you in there? Jenny, I can't believe you did this." It was her boyfriend. She waited quietly with me until he split, and we ended up spending the rest of the day together. We stayed in town the next night as well, and our host threw a party at their house. The boyfriend showed up. I don't know what he was thinking. I was with his girl on the other side of the room, and he was too meek to do anything about it other than stew on the couch. It was any guy's worst nightmare. But of course, I made it worse. At one point, he muttered something along the lines of, "I should kick your ass," under his breath when I was in earshot. In the middle of the fucking party, I turned and loudly said, "What, motherfucker?" He was silent. But I announced to everyone the insider information that Jenny had shared with me earlier. "Maybe if you knew how to fuck, your chick wouldn't be sucking my fucking cock and hanging out with me." As if I hadn't humiliated him enough, I pressed on, this time challenging both his courage and manhood while mocking a physical feature about which he was probably already self-conscious. "As a matter of fact, you keep talking, I'm going to take you outside, fuck your girlfriend, and make your nose even bigger." Yeah, I may as well have ripped off his balls and shoved them down his throat while I was at it. Jenny should have realized that I was a piece of shit and walked away, but instead she followed us to our next several shows. She showed up and sang me some Broadway number about "Our Love Is Here" and "Take Me Now Before You Regret It," or some nonsense. I told her repeatedly to go home and that I was not into her, but she followed us all the way to fucking Wisconsin before she gave up. We later immortalized her stalker behavior in a song on our Ribbed album. The takeaway from all this is that drugs and booze make for some memorable nights, but they also make for some nights you wish you could forget. Also, if I ever get murdered, it's probably Jenny's boyfriend or maybe that jello mold girl.
Chapter 46, Steve, as channeled by Charles Manson's smarter brother. My first show with no effects was at the Coconut Teaser, a Hollywood dive that drew crowds by offering free beer and hot dogs to starving punks and metalheads on Wednesday nights. We were playing second on a bill with Wasted Youth, The Adolescents, Tender Fury, and The Grim, and an unknown band from Seattle called Nirvana who didn't bother to show. I was awful. I maybe got through S&M Airlines and one other song with some amount of competence, but beyond that I was a mess. But then I realized no one cared. Whenever someone from GIT played a show, the other students would all turn out to quote-unquote support their colleague, but they would usually just stand in the audience with their arms folded thinking, "I could have played that better." Not the punks. They were wasted and happy, and they seemed to like me. And the guys in the band didn't bat an eye at any of my mistakes. Things moved fast those first few months. I had to learn the entire S&M Airlines album in 3 weeks, and then it was straight into the studio. People later blamed me for bringing a metal influence to the S&M Airlines album, but all of the songs were written and demoed well before I joined. My only previous recording experience had been with Tantrum and Kamikaze Ken in a converted guest house, and suddenly I'm in a real studio with Brett Gurwitz. I had just heard NoFX for the first time a month earlier, and there I was signing and initialing some piece of paper that said something or other about percentages and royalties that, to this day, I've never read. We shot a video for S&M Airlines with then-unknown director Gore Verbinski that began with a live show at the Anti Club. I dislocated my knee in the middle of the set and consequently fell onto a bed of bottles and pint glasses left at my feet by all the people drinking near the stage. I had no medical insurance, so I never considered going to the hospital. I just wrapped my knee in an ace bandage and went with the band out to Edwards Air Force Base the next day to continue the video shoot on one of the tarmacs. I couldn't move much with a jacked knee, so in the video, Melvin is the one doing all the jumping, not that I could ever keep up with him anyway. All I could really do was a little Chuck Berry hop, which you can see Mike and Melvin doing with me in the video, in either a show of solidarity or mockery. Likely a bit of both. For a low-budget punk rock music video, it was an ambitious shoot. I remember a moment when Gore duct-taped the camera to the end of a long PVC pipe and dangled it over the tarmac from his pickup truck as his friend drove at us at top speed. Gore pulled the camera up just before it collided with Fat Mike's grill to get a whipping overhead crane shot. Years later, when I was watching Pirates of the Caribbean with my son and Gore's name appeared on the screen, I laughed out and said, "I know that guy." The word tour was the one that perked my ears up when I first got to know Eric Melvin. It was the mark of a real working band, and it meant adventure and excitement around every corner. But much like moving to Los Angeles, and much like attending music school, touring fell far short of my expectations. For 3.5 months, we were trapped in a dry-cleaning delivery van with no rear seats, an odorous mattress flopped on a plywood platform above the gear, and a side door that opened only occasionally. We were surviving on a $2 for $2 meal deal at Burger King every day, and we were playing shows in backyards, often getting paid solely in beer. The days off were brutal when we were stuck in the middle of nowhere with nothing to do, and everywhere we went, people kept saying, "You're not Dave," or treating me like, or addressing me as, Sammy Hagar, usually brought on by Fat Mike introducing me that way in the crowd. Sleeping on floors and going without showers was tough at first, but I got used to it, and when I got a box full of the first pressing of S&M Airlines shipped to us on the road, it was a highlight not just of the tour, but also of my young life. I had never been on a real record before. The feeling of validation sustained me for weeks, but our tours lasted for months, and our tours also featured the Moron Brothers. Do you know what a pressed ham is? It's when you're sleeping nose up and someone squats over you without any undergarments on and tries to touch your nose with their butthole. I once woke up to Eric Sandin mere millimeters away from completing such a mission on my face. Butterballs was a game in which Sandin or DJ would wipe their fingers on their nutsack or asshole, approach an unsuspecting victim, and smear their stink into that person's nose. They'd say, "Butterballs!" and expect you to guess where the smell came from, butt or balls. I don't care what kind of soap you use, that stench stays with you forever. A butt trumpet begins when you stick a garden hose up your ass and load your colon with water. I remember watching Sandin prep himself just so. Pull his pants up, and approach some poor guy at a backyard party sitting in a lawn chair. I never felt so lucky to not be another person as when I watched Eric drop his pants, bend over, and evacuate his runny bowels into the guy's lap. While the ass-related pranks were usually the vilest, some of the more subtle ones were more vicious. On one rare occasion, I lucked into the shotgun seat in the van. Sandin and DJ had somehow acquired a couple of spray bottles full of water. Every few seconds, as we crossed the endless desert of New Mexico, they would squirt the back of my head. It started as a minor annoyance, then a knock it off, you assholes, then it devolved into full-on Chinese water torture. Just when I thought they'd stopped for good, squirt, squirt. It went on for hundreds of miles. Squirt, squirt. I don't know where they were getting water to keep refilling the bottles, and I don't like thinking about the possibility that it wasn't even water after a while. Squirt, squirt. What astonished me was that they never got to a point where they decided the joke was over. Never was there a moment of, okay, he's had enough, or, okay, this is getting boring. It went on endlessly, regardless of my reaction or lack thereof. I just leaned forward and stared at the dashboard, contemplating my life. Squirt, squirt. Mike, of course, found it hilarious. Partying in L.A. for me was about looking as cool as you could while shit-faced, while looking for hot chicks to tell you how cool you looked while shit-faced. Partying on the road with Sandin was an entirely different and rabid animal. For one thing, the cuties in the punk scene at the time were few and far between, and for another, there was no competing with Eric. He could charm the chrome off a bumper, even if he was blind drunk with tampons dangling from his hair. Before you noticed the cute girl on the couch, Eric was already literally doing handstands to impress her. Minutes later, they'd be off in the next room or out in the van or on the swing set of the local park, and using my towel as a sex rag. At this point, all the girls I had been with were long-term girlfriends. Meanwhile, Eric and DJ had a competition to see who could hook up with the most girls during a tour. The prize was a cardboard crown from Burger King, and the motto was, quantity, not quality. They were tied 10-10 towards the end of the tour when Eric met a not-so-quality, hefty young woman from Albuquerque who was begging him to have sex with her. She followed him around all night, then followed our van to 7-Eleven. He took her around the back and humped her in the dirt next to the dumpster after she agreed to buy him a bottle of Night Train. He returned to the van and announced with an equal mix of pride and shame, 11. DJ stayed an extra night in Vegas after the last night of the tour. He hooked up with one last girl and took the Greyhound back to L.A. in an attempt to make the competition a tie, but his final play was nullified upon review. Sandin won the crowd. Although I hear the Albuquerque girl stalked Eric for a while, and he had to go by the alias the Great Waldo Pepper whenever he checked into a hotel in New Mexico from then on. It's amazing what you can get used to. After enough time on tour, it was hardly a surprise to be asleep under a piano in someone's house and be woken up by the Moron Brothers bowling an empty pony keg at me. Since it apparently wasn't time to go to sleep yet, I stayed up and watched them put a fellow house guest in an improvised body cast. I couldn't stop those guys from spraying me with a water bottle. Do you think I could have stopped them from throwing a grill through a window or jumping on a car and caving in its windshield the same night? Do you think I could have stopped them from devouring an art student's final project the next night or stopped them from further torturing that poor art student by using her camera to take pictures of themselves, sticking her toothbrushes up their asses? This was back in the days of film cameras. Who knows how long she and her roommates used those brushes before developing the photos? A good night's sleep was something I stopped expecting early on. I remember one night we were supposed to stay at some place called the Vomit House. I had been in the band long enough to know that it probably wasn't called the Vomit House because it was full of flowers and feather beds. In fact, right as we pulled up, someone was vomiting off the balcony. Aaron had flown in that night to visit Mike on tour, so they were going to get a hotel room for some private time, and I figured I could go with them and sleep in the van. We drove around for a couple hours, but ultimately they couldn't find a room. After some awkward glances, I realized I was cock-blocking them, so I took my sleeping bag and rolled it out under the van. When the vehicle above me stopped rocking back and forth, I finally drifted off, but was woken up in the middle of a REM cycle by a flashlight and a cop shouting at me to come out. It's a bleak moment when you realize you would have been more comfortable at the vomit house. Through the lens of nostalgia, some of these stories sound humorous, but when you're in the thick of it, you're not laughing as hard. And things could go from ridiculous to scary at a moment's notice. Ridiculous. Eric and DJ spent the afternoon in New Orleans stealing gaudy tourist clothes from a souvenir shop. Scary. That night there was a huge brawl at our show, during which the power went off, the security guards got beat up, and they had to clear the place out. The owner let us stay and drink for free after everyone was gone. At one moment I reached over the bar to give myself a refill. I looked up to see the barrel of the owner's revolver level with my nose. You can have all you want, but you'll ask for what you get. Point taken, brother. One of the darkest nights, though, was when we played with DOA in Minneapolis, and after the show, Eric, Melvin, and I were talking to a NoFX fan backstage. The kids seemed a little socially awkward and out of place, so Melvin and I, always feeling a little awkward ourselves, invited him to party with us at the house where we were staying. I never saw him arrive at the party. I was exhausted, possibly from being up all night at some place like the Vomit House, so I passed out in the back of the van after a couple beers. I woke up to sirens and flashing lights speeding down the street. Cop cars and ambulances had gathered half a block away. We heard someone had shown up to the party, struck up a conversation with the wrong person's girlfriend or something, and gotten chased down and stomped by a bunch of skinheads. After investigating further, Melvin and I figured out it was the kid we had invited. The beating was so severe that he died from his injuries. This was the inspiration for the song Malachi Crunch. I was glad when Mike wrote it. The death of this anonymous punk kid probably barely made the local news, but hopefully the song allows him some form of immortality. None of this was happening the way I thought it was supposed to happen. Tour was supposed to be fun. Fights weren't supposed to break out. Guns weren't supposed to be drawn. Beer wasn't supposed to equal money. Drummers weren't supposed to destroy everything. People weren't supposed to die. I was ready for adventure, and I was ready for a struggle, but I wasn't ready for this, and I wasn't ready for a junkie roommate either.
Chapter 47, Melvin. I'll take credit for coining the term Moron Brothers. I forgot when I said it, but it's a misremembered quote from the movie Splash. Eugene Levy is on a quest to prove the existence of a mermaid, and he has two idiot assistants. In one scene, Tom Hanks asks Levy if there's anyone else around. Levy replies, "No, just me and the moron twins." And I love the reply, "We're not twins." It wasn't only the name that fit Smelling DJ so well, but the hint of exasperation in Levy's voice that so subtly captured the feelings of annoyance and embarrassment brought on by hanging out with those guys. They inspired a song on a Ribbed album. Most people assume the lyrics are fictional or an exaggeration, but every line comes from the exploits of Smelly and DJ. They'd get drunk and drugged out of their minds every single night and immediately channel their energy into creating chaos, mostly by peeing on stuff. I usually steered clear of their bullshit. Steve and I became pot buddies. So whenever we saw Smelly and DJ walk through a door with another 12-pack of Milwaukee's Best, we left to find somewhere else to smoke. They stole drugs from people's medicine cabinets, vomited on cue, and broke everything they touched. The Moron Brothers were a guaranteed disaster. Other disasters we could usually manage to avoid, narrowly. We had yet another tire blowout while touring through the middle of the country somewhere, but instead of pulling over to the shoulder, we pulled onto the median in the middle of the highway. I forget where we were exactly, but we were close to a big city, so there were five lanes of cars whizzing by nonstop on either side of us. We needed to get to the shoulder to find a call box, but our gimpy van wasn't going to get us there. Someone needed to run across the road. I volunteered. Hell, I was an Eagle Scout. I could rescue us from this mess. Squatting in the ready position like an Olympic sprinter, I waited for a break in the traffic. The flow of cars never ceased entirely, but I figured I could navigate my way across by letting the nearest car pass and waiting for the furthest lane to clear while I was running, Frogger style. When the perfect pattern emerged, I took off. I rolled my ankle and went down in the center lane. Car horns blared, and my friends went from cheering to desperately yelling, "Get up!" I was already up. My body automatically popped back up off the ground, but my ankle was fucked. I hopped on one foot and dragged the other, trying to ignore the pain shooting through my leg and the cars growing larger in my peripheral vision. I crossed the white finish line that marked the shoulder and slumped to the ground, out of breath. I painfully hobbled my way to a call box. We made the show that night just fine. We were leaving a bar in Buffalo at 2 a.m. after drinking since 6 p.m., and we were following our friend, Suicidal Steve, back to his house. Mike was driving, and we had stuffed the van full of friends who wanted a party. Suicidal Steve went through a stale yellow light, and we got stuck at the red. No one was around except for one distant pair of headlights in the rear view. Mike gambled that those headlights didn't belong to a cop and turned left through the red light. He lost the gamble. We emptied out of the van, and the cop lined us up on the curb. "You guys been drinking?" It was a rhetorical question. We were obviously blind drunk and clearly busted. "No, officer. We're just leaving a show and going to a friend's house." The cop went to open the side door of the van, and all of us in unison explained, "It doesn't open." The door had been broken for a while. It would unlatch, but it would only slide open a few inches. When the cop unlatched the door, an avalanche of half-empty bottles and cans and a river of beer spilled out onto the street through the small opening. We were too drunk to be scared. With all those open containers, there was no possible way we weren't going to jail. So worrying wasn't going to help us. Mike was standing and DJ was seated on the curb, so Mike chose that moment to let out a loud fart in DJ's face. Everyone cracked up, except the cop. He spun around and asked, "What's so damn funny?" "Sorry, sir, he just farted on my head." We laughed even harder. The cop looked at our group and did some mental math about what the rest of his night was going to be like dealing with us. "Get the fuck out of here." When we got to Suicidal Steve's house, Suicidal Steve wasn't there. His roommate told us he'd been arrested for drunk driving.
Chapter 48, Steve, as channeled through Saddam Disney. For all my complaining about him, Eric Sandin and I got along great when he was sober. By sober, I mean when he wasn't drunk. He wouldn't be truly sober until a couple of years after I left the band. But in the meantime, we talked about dirt bikes and music, and I considered him a good friend. I had no first-hand experience with junkies. I had seen and done my fair share of partying, but heroin was something for jazz greats and Lenny Bruce. When Eric was on tour, it was the alcohol that fueled his worst behavior. He kept his smack use out of sight. I heard him puking one night, but didn't know if it meant he had used good or bad shit. When we were back in L.A., we didn't hang out enough for me to notice it affecting his life. I was naive about his addiction and about the power of heroin itself. One of my first lessons in dealing with junkies came after a No Effects show in Tijuana with Bad Religion and Big Drill Car. It was a crazy night with kids jumping off third-story balconies into the crowd, some poor girl breaking her nose as a result, and me wriggling away from an unattractive but persistent groupie. After the show, I let Eric and two of our other friends, who I found out later were also struggling with heroin addiction, crash at my place. I left my money from the show on the coffee table overnight. When I woke up, it was gone. And later, I also discovered a large gap in my record collection. I don't know which one of them stole my stuff, but I used to believe all three of them were good guys and good friends. Betrayal wasn't in their nature. That's what heroin does to people. Sandin told me he was taking steps to get clean, so I agreed to let him stay at my place for a few weeks between tours. Early every morning, before I went to work, I got up and drove him out to the valley to get methadone. And every night I listened to him scream in his sleep. I didn't understand methadone at the time. I didn't realize it was meant to kill the cravings. I thought he was getting high off the stuff. I felt like I was being duped, just like when my money and records were stolen. And then one day, I found a burnt spoon behind my toilet. We were leaving for tour, and we had to pick up Eric somewhere. I was in the van. Eric walked up with his new snare drum in his hand. Another junkie had stolen and pawned his other one. I stuck my foot out and calmly planted it in Eric's chest. "How many times did I tell you I didn't want that shit at my house? What are you talking about?" I explained that I'd found the spoon. He still didn't get it, or at least pretended not to. I spelled it out for him. Neither that shit nor anyone using that shit was welcome at my pad. He didn't get mad or make a big deal out of it. He just changed the subject in order to deflect any discussion of his problem. "You actually clean behind the toilet?"
Chapter 49, Mike. When we went back to Europe after S&M Airlines came out, we were shocked by the response. In Germany, we played a sold-out headlining gig to 350 fans who were slamming and singing along the whole time. Much better than being booed off the stage and pelted with bottles in Frankfurt 2 years earlier. Even though we were slowly gaining a following in the States, our shows never drew more than 100 people. This was the first indication that we were on a better path. We slept at the club, and the next morning, around 10 a.m., Smelly discovered that they didn't lock the bar. He grabbed a bottle of Jägermeister and said, "This is my breakfast," and downed half the fucking thing before we even loaded into the van. He went from lucid to plowed in about 10 minutes. 3 hours later, we pull into Amsterdam and everyone got out of the van. Smelly sat down on the curb, then slowly lay down, and then passed out. He laid his head on something that looked like a pillow to him, but it was in fact a pile of dog shit. Strangely, Smelly was not the worst drunk on the trip. That honor belongs to our booking agent, Dave Pollock, who passed on our first European tour. After hearing our new album, he agreed to book us in Europe when Dolph politely declined the privilege of working with us again. Dave has booked every European tour since then, and he's become family. But he's a family member you hide from after his third glass of wine. Dave has spent years training in the art of karate. Every morning, we would hear him in the hallway of the hotel, doing an hour-long routine. Ha! Ho! Ha! Ho! And after the shows, when he was wasted, he would explain a dozen ways he could kick your ass and then punch you for no reason. The man is over 50 years old, but if you are listening to these words after midnight Berlin time, Dave Pollock is out there right now, wasted, putting someone in a slow-motion chokehold. Still, he booked us a surprisingly successful tour, especially compared to the debacle from 2 years prior. And we actually flew home with a small profit. It was the best-case scenario for NoFX at the time, not a total fiasco. Playing chess with Brett Gurewitz is no fun. Brett is too fucking smart, and he's read all the strategy books, so he always wins. I could beat him occasionally at speed chess, but I've only beaten him once at regular chess, I think. That could have been a dream, though. While we were working on our next album, Ribbed, Brett insisted we play chess at least twice a day during recording, and a full game between every mix. We only had 10 days of studio time to finish the whole record. Added up, we must have wasted at least two of those days at the chessboard. It was theoretically a way to blow off stress, but it just added to my frustration level. When I recorded the vocals, I ran into the same problems. I absolutely could not sing in key. I go over some of the lines 40 or 50 times and still end up with a not-that-great version. Brett thought a good way to mask my shitty singing was to layer lots of vocal harmonies. But three-part vocal harmonies were a signature of Bad Religion sound, and I didn't want to copy them so directly. Especially since people had already started comparing our bands after S&M Airlines came out. I protested the harmonies, but Brett was convinced I would love the end result. so he would spend an hour or two working out the harmony parts and then play them for me. I would say I didn't like them, and he would fly off the handle about having wasted a big chunk of time. And then he quit. Thankfully, he showed up the next day, and we pretended like things were fine. But he kept suggesting ideas and working on parts that sounded like Bad Religion. At one point, it boiled over, and we yelled in each other's faces. "You're ruining my record.
You don't fucking listen to me. I know how to make you guys big."
"But you're making us sound like Bad Religion."
"I'm the producer. I know what I'm talking about."
It got ugly. My eyes teared up. I didn't want to argue with my friend and mentor, but I also didn't want to be written off as a Bad Religion clone. It made no sense to me to have grand operatic harmonies and a goofy song about two drunk idiots with STDs. We butted heads about it, he quit again, and walked out of the session. This time it was for real. He was done, gone, never coming back. And then he showed up again the next morning like nothing had ever happened. It was the worst recording experience I've ever had, but somehow Brett and I came out of it as friends. I remember finishing the final mix at 5 a.m. and going back to Brett's house to celebrate. We blasted the record at full volume. We were stoked. His wife Maggie was not. We knew we had made something great together, and we were proud of what we had accomplished. Every single argument had been buried and forgotten. Within the first year, Ribbed sold 10,000 copies, four times as much as S&M Airlines. The crowds at our shows jumped by the same degree, and the reviewers talked significantly less shit. A fanzine called Half Truth, put out by Rich Wilkes, who went on to write the screenplays for Billy Madison and Airheads, somehow got Charles Bukowski to review the record, possibly due to the fact that our song Green Corn is based on Bukowski's movie Barfly. He wrote, "Thanks for sending the cassette. My wife played it full blast. I said, hey, hey, what the fuck?" Almost everyone points to Ribbed as a record that solidified the NoFX sound, and they're right. S&M Airlines marked the moment when we knew what we wanted to sound like, but Ribbed actually sounded like the record we wanted to sound like. But everyone still said we sounded like Bad Religion.
Chapter 50. Steve, as channeled through Elvis Rehnquist. All the group vocals for Ribbed were recorded with everyone's pants around their ankles. We had Pat Mack from the band Tex and the Horseheads and Mark Curry from the Dog Patch Winos in there with us doing the doo-wop harmonies at the end of New Boobs, and we needed some way to keep our minds busy so we wouldn't psych ourselves out. I did the monologue part at the end of the song. Dave Smalley from All and DYS did the high-pitched crooning part, but he asked us not to credit him on the album because, I quote, "I don't want anybody to know." He even made up a story about his whereabouts when he was on the phone with his wife. New Boobs was actually the most fun I would ever have in a recording studio. There was a pick slide in the song, which Mike did on my guitar with a credit card while I was playing. The vocal booth was covered in torn-out pages from porn magazines. Knowing Brett Gurwitz, it was most likely Jugs. And I smashed a guitar at the end of the song and ruined one of Brett's microphones in the process. Brett had just bought a brand new mic that he claimed was worth $10,000. We were getting ready to do the guitar smashing take, and he kept saying, "Whatever you do, don't hit my mic." We laid an old metal shelving unit on its back in the driveway for me to smash the guitar into. I wasn't even going to be swinging the guitar in the direction of the mic, let alone anywhere near it. "Whatever you do, don't hit my mic." "Brett, I'm swinging the guitar way over here. I'm not an idiot." Tape's rolling. I swing the guitar. It hits the corner of the shelving unit and shatters. A fist-sized chunk of wood ricochets back over my shoulder and hits the friggin' mic. I kept smashing away. We got the take. Long after I'm gone, future generations will be able to hear the sound of me destroying Brett's $10,000 baby on wax, disc, or MP3. But for the rest of the recording session, all I heard was, "Dude, you hit my mic." More trivia. Together in the Sand is really just Crazy Train played jazz style. I never had much musical input when it came to songwriting, but when I got my window, I threw in a healthy dose of Randy Rhoads. A couple months after we finished recording, We were booked with Pennywise and Bad Religion at the El Portal Theater in North Hollywood, but only Pennywise played. We were wheeling our gear on stage when the fire marshal demanded that everybody in the crowd sit down. He was counting the number of attendees to see if the show was oversold, and it was. I was plugged in, tuned up, and pulling a guitar pick out of my pocket to play when the fire marshal walked over to me and said, "Quietly turn off your amp and roll it off the stage." I looked him straight in the eye and said, "Do not fucking shut down this show! Please." But his mind was made up. The crowd tore the seats out of the floor, hurled bottles, and pulled down the velvet curtains on either side of the stage. I snuck out into the alley. As police helicopters approached and circled overhead, I went around the front of the venue just in time to see the cops push a guy through a plate glass door. The shards tore his arm open all the way around. It looked like the goo that bursts out one of those cans of Pillsbury biscuit dough when it pops open into a spiral. All the display windows along the front of the building, as well as the windows around the ticket booth and on every storefront for several blocks in each direction, were smashed by the crowd soon after that. Fire trucks showed up and blew people down the street with their hoses. It was the end of December 1990, and another year with no effects had come to a close.
Chapter 51, Mike. Steve was mellower than Smelly or Dave or the other Dave, but he was still, in my expert opinion, an alcoholic. He wouldn't black out or go crazy. He would just down a 12-pack every night and sweat out a gallon of booze into the van seats as he slept. It was so gross. Once we stopped at a gas station after 2 a.m., he went inside to get some beer because he needed it to fall asleep. In his haze, he didn't notice the word root over the word beer on the 6-pack he purchased. He didn't sleep well that night. We returned to Europe for the third time in the spring of 91, and our crowds had gotten way bigger. This time we were playing to 300 or 400 people every night, and we came home with almost $2,500 apiece in profit, which was completely unthinkable just a few years earlier. We saw where we were headed, and we were all stoked. Except for Steve. Steve saw us touring in a van, not a bus. Steve saw us sleeping in squats, not hotels. Steve saw us making $2,500 per tour, not per show. From the perspective of other punk bands in the early 90s, we were living the dream. But through the lens of the Hollywood rock world, we were going nowhere. He started complaining about the shows and accommodations and pretty much anything else he could think of. We never had any big arguments, but it was obvious he was unhappy. A week after we returned from Europe, he told me he didn't see us making a living as NOFX and he was leaving the band. He had a plan. He was going to join a band with his friend Skip, a guitar tech for Guns N' Roses, and they were going to play real rock and roll and make real money. I begged him to stay. He added so much to our sound, and he was great on stage, and he wasn't a kleptomaniac. I knew replacing him would be tough, especially since we had a U.S. tour booked only a few weeks later. I offered to guarantee him a set amount of money if he stayed on for the whole next tour, figuring the rest of us could take a hit until we reached the next level, or at least sold a few more records. He wasn't interested. Punk was a dead-end street. He needed to find a more lucrative genre of music. 3 months later, Nirvana's Nevermind came out.
Dope.
If Steve had stayed in the band for one more year, he would have seen everything change, and he would probably still be in NOFX to this day. Nevermind was an extinction-level event in the music industry. LA hair metal was dead. Alternative, grunge, and punk took over. Even though NOFX wasn't on any record company's radar, curious kids flooded into record stores around the world to research Nirvana's punk influences, and some of them accidentally stumbled onto bands like ours. It might have helped that our band name also started with N. The following years would turn out very well for NOFX. Steve never did start that band with the Guns N' Roses dude. Years later, he ended up in a country punk band called Speed Buggy for a while. He currently works with a tattoo artist in Merced, California, and does construction on the side. We keep in touch every now and then. On more than one occasion, he said, only half-jokingly, "If you're ever looking for a guitar player, you know who to call."
Chapter 52, Steve, as channeled by Dyke Van Dyke. The myth has persisted for years that I left the band because I wanted to become a rock star. The truth is, I left the band because I could no longer afford to be in it. After my first European tour, I not only came home without having made a profit, but I also owed Mike $100. After my second European tour, I came home with $1,200. I could have come home with more, but I was buying drinks, I got my first tattoo, and I got a terrible currency exchange rate at the airport. Plus, our roadie, Timmy the Turtle, was pickpocketed somewhere along the way, and I ended up covering a lot of his meals and drinks for the rest of the trip, so that was a chunk of money I never saw again. Which isn't such a bad deal after 2 months of seeing the world and getting fed every night, but in order to do the tour, I had to quit the warehouse job Melvin had gotten me at Fred Siegel, and it wasn't waiting for me when I returned. The other guys all had some form or another of family support or were simply living on the street, but my parents were tapped out after GIT. Ribbed and S&M Airlines were selling well but were far from recouping, and the band still owed Mike money from the recording of earlier albums, and I assumed Dave's portion of that debt, so I wasn't exactly waiting behind my mailbox for a royalty check. When I had to sell one of my guitars to make rent, I realized I was facing a serious decision about how much longer I could survive as a member of NoFX. The tragic comedy of the second European tour made the decision for me. Halfway through, we hit a fucking deer. It was on a drive through the Alps, somewhere between Switzerland and France. I was asleep in the back of the van, lying on a mattress that had been bungee corded to our speaker cabinets. I suddenly woke up in the front of the van, having been thrown over two rows of seats. Our driver, Herman the German, said, "I hit the Bambi." Herman, who earlier in the tour was sleeping in the van while one of the windows was smashed and our luggage stolen, told us there were three deer in the road. He swerved to miss two but slammed into the third. The front end was wrecked, and our radiator was destroyed. We were able to limp the van to a gas station, but of course it was closed because it was like 4 in the morning. Herman and I hiked back to the highway and found some police who called us a tow truck. We ended up renting a moving truck for the rest of the tour. We had a little more room, but I questioned how safe we were, sliding around in the back with all of our gear clumsily tied down and at risk of falling all over us. We also had to strap the back door open a bit so we could breathe, which allowed in all the exhaust fumes. When I said I wondered about surviving in NoFX, I meant it literally. As the tour progressed, I drank more heavily to keep my growing annoyance at bay. I ended up causing us to miss our first show in Ireland because our roadie Timmy the Turtle and I were chasing beers with shots of Southern Comfort in some London pub when we were supposed to be boarding our ferry. Melvin somehow found us and freaked out about how we'd gone missing. I figured we'd just catch the next ferry, but it doesn't work like that. You need advance tickets and custom clearances for the gear. Our driver drove south and somehow conned our van and gear onto a ferry along with a line of other vans that were part of Gloria Estefan's tour. The rest of us had to catch a separate boat a day later. Sandon had been able to score dope with relative ease in London, but in Ireland he was cut off. After several days, he completely fell apart. I never saw his heroin problem interfere with a show until one night in Ireland when he couldn't get through a single song properly. I never watched Eric play drums before. I never had any need to look back and check on him because he always held it together. Now I was looking back in the middle of every song. He could barely stay seated on the drum stool, let alone play. It didn't go unnoticed by the crowd, and half of them threw bottles and shouted, "Go back to America!" I realized we would get a phone call one day with the news that Eric had OD'd. Then I realized we'd be lucky if we even got a phone call. Does the guy even carry a wallet half the time? He would disappear for days on tour. How long would he go missing before anyone realized something was wrong? He would just be another nameless bum swept away with the weekly garbage pickup. And then what would happen to NoFX? The financial straits, the miserable drives, the dead deer, the black cloud of drug addiction, all of it on top of 3 years of vomit houses and moron brothers. It swirled in my head and it weighed on my back until it broke me at the last show of the tour in Bremen, Germany with Bad Religion. Aaron and a few other girlfriends had flown out to meet the band during the tour. Our van was already cramped enough, and now we were accommodating several hangers-on. After our Bremen sound check, I had to solder something on my guitar, and when I finished, I went to eat dinner with the band. They were all in this big restaurant booth, and in front of them was a pile of scraps where our food had been. The band and their girlfriends had eaten everything and left me with nothing. Mike apologetically offered me a plate of his half-eaten leftovers. On most other days, maybe it wouldn't have been such a big deal, but with everything else on my mind, I melted down. My guitar playing was paying for that food. Why were their girlfriends eating when I wasn't? To add insult to injury, we were kicked out of our hotel that night because they saw us trying to sneak all the extra girlfriends into our room. I had to spend the night on the floor of Bad Religion's Road Crew's hotel room. Bremen, Germany would be my last show with NoFX. It was actually one of our better performances. Kids were doing flips off the monitors and some girls from the crowd sang Together on the Sand with me. One of Bad Religion's roadies shot a video of the whole show and showed it to us afterwards. Other than our music videos, it was the first time I had seen myself on stage with NoFX. Video was rare back then, even when people shot our shows and never saw the tapes. This video captured us after 3 years of playing together in a country far from home with a happy and supportive crowd at a moment when we were on our game musically yet still having fun. It was a touching time capsule that would always allow me to remember the good times with NoFX. I loaned the tape to Eric Melvin. I never saw it again. I never made a definitive announcement that I was quitting. I just let it drunkenly slip out to Melvin at a party. He was crushed. We were close buddies, bonded over 1,000 nights of sneaking off to smoke weed while avoiding the standard NoFX chaos. I was too chicken shit to tell Mike directly. I've never been good with confrontations, which is probably why I allowed so much friction to build up between the band and me in the first place. I second-guessed myself heavily after I made the decision. Did I do the right thing? Did I just blow my friendship with these guys forever? I was relieved when I got a call from Mike inviting me to a Dodger game. We were able to sit down as friends and enjoy some hot dogs and beer. It was clear that NoFX was letting my departure roll off their backs just like they did with everything else. I don't remember Mike trying to convince me to rejoin the band. If he did, I probably dismissed it, not thinking he was serious. I just remember having a good time with a friend and watching Daryl Strawberry hit 2 home runs and a grand slam. Later, Mike would joke to people that the reason I quit was because I got hit by a foul ball and couldn't remember how to play the songs. It was one of those many myths that obscured the truth over the years. Other myths were that we were driven apart because of my religious views or my supposed alcoholism, but the truth is we rarely talked about my Christianity, thank God. And I certainly wasn't drinking any more than Melvin or Sandin or my predecessor Dave. Mike was the heaviest drinker of all of us, but that's not saying much. On that second European tour, we went to a bar in the Reeperbahn area of Hamburg, and they had these tree stumps there for the purpose of playing Hammerschlagen. Everyone gets a hammer and a nail. Mix those two with booze, and you know you're in for a good time. And the last guy to drive his nail all the way into the stump buys the next round. By the end of that night, Mike was so tanked he was pissing in the middle of the street. We had called a cab to take us back where we were staying, and when we pulled up, Mike pissed all over the hood and bumper. We had to carry him up several flights of stairs, and in the morning, I found him with his head submerged in the toilet. We dragged him into the breakfast room, where he lay in the corner while we ate, and then we carried him to the van afterwards. He said he would never drink again. My understanding is he has not adhered to that vow. I didn't need booze to fall asleep, but it definitely helped on the nights when I was sprawled out under a piano having pony kegs bowled my way, and the story about me buying root beer was just a bleary-eyed mistake in a dry county in the middle of the night that could have happened to anybody. There were also myths about my leaving the band in pursuit of a money-making career in heavy metal. I ended up in a band with my friend Skip, but it wasn't something we had planned while I was still in NOFX. We just played together because we were friends. Our songs never made it out of the living room. People also claim that Skip was a roadie for Guns N' Roses or something, but again, false. He did work for a company that rented audio gear to some of the bigger bands at the time, though. I helped him deliver the 24-track recorder to Metallica's studio when they were working on the Black Album. We were in there alone, so I moved all the mics on Lars's drum kit a millimeter or two. I wonder if they ever noticed, or if I should demand a co-engineering credit on that record. I jammed with a band called Twister Naked for a while, and later I started a country punk hybrid called Speed Buggy, which was renamed Speed Buggy USA after we found a band in Canada had already snagged the name. We toured a bit, and we opened for NOFX a few times, and it turned out my problem with NOFX wasn't necessarily NOFX, it was the life of a touring musician that didn't agree with me. Speed Buggy went to Europe, and the same old frustrations reared their ugly heads while enduring longer drives, smaller vans, and lower paydays than the tours with NOFX. I drank heavily just to get through it, and I recognized quickly that that wasn't healthy. Plus, by that point, I'd gotten married and had a 1-year-old baby at home. So arguing with my fellow drunks while riding shoulder to shoulder in the middle of the night through Denmark to get to a show attended by 5 people wasn't where I really wanted to be. After one too many stupid arguments, I vindictively ditched the band in the middle of a tour. Their driver filled in on guitar for the rest of the dates. I guess I'm more easily replaceable than I'd like to believe. Even though they've had admirable success, I never felt like I missed the boat by leaving NOFX. It took at least 2 or 3 years before I saw my first royalty check, and it took another 2 or 3 years before I got one that was big enough to make me do a double take. There's no way I would have been able to hack it for that long, and banking